powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by the Pro Club. Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross here. We are joined now by Fox Sports college football insider Bruce Feldman. Bruce, how are you?
I'm doing well. Good to be out with you guys.
Good. We obviously have to start with the Larry Scott news. No better person to have on to talk about that. Now, the beginning of his tenure was initially seen as, okay, he's the right guy for the job. Obviously, by the end, it felt like the writing was on the wall. Where did that relationship start to sour in your mind?
Well, I think it's just been so many embarrassing public gaffes by the Pac-12 and the and him in particular, where it's just a lot of tone-deaf moves. And I think there's just been, it's been one thing after another that I think at this point the Pac-12 reputation has been so torpedoed by this. You know, you would go down the list. I mean, I just think it's that at this point, it feels like it's been this way, probably headed this direction for about 3 years now. I don't know if there was one particular tipping point, but it's just been one story after another that has just been really damning. And I don't think all of it is his fault, but I think one of the biggest frustrations from talking to people who work in the conference over the years has been they really do not have a great handle on what the main thing and keeping the main thing is, which is something the Big Ten and the SEC, especially in the ACC, have always had a better feel for, whereas the Pac-12 seems to, you know, bend over backward to go in a completely different direction, often at the expense of the conference members themselves.
Bruce, excited to have you on, a Fox Sports college football insider. Tremendous, tremendous follow on Twitter and everything that he does, all the books that he has written. But Bruce, you talk about the deterioration of the Pac-12. How can the Pac-12 get back to being a desired destination again? I mean, it seems like they have a lot of work ahead of them, but you talk about it from a recruiting standpoint, you talk about it from a coaching standpoint, the Pac-12 doesn't seem to be a destination point anymore.
Well, Jake, I think some of the issues are not Larry Scott's fault at all. I think the biggest problem I think the Pac-12 has had reputation-wise has been that USC, the flagship program, has been spinning its wheels, and to similar to extent, like the Pac-12's issue, USC has often been its own worst enemy, and has had a hard time getting out of its own way. Mm. And I think a lot of that stems from bad decisions at the leadership spot, where, especially under Pat Payton and Lynn Swann, but even under Mike Garrett before that, and I think Pete Carroll made a lot of those, incompetence stuff. Pete Carroll was able to make that mask it because he was such a good coach and was such a good fit for what USC needed. And so you had this team that was the dominant powerhouse in college football, and it made, honestly, West Coast football feel very cool. And then after he left, the sanctions hit. And I still think there was a lot of kids who grew up wanting to be Reggie Bush or whoever the star of USC at the time was. You pick your receiver, you pick your defensive player. And so there were still a lot of kids who were going to go there. But, you know, over time, you know, I remember there was a year where, I think it was the third year Jim Mora had been the head coach. You saw he had beaten USC three times in a row. And then on signing day, head-to-head, he still lost a bunch of the battles. And I credit to Moore, he had enough self-awareness to go, look, you know, this didn't happen overnight. It's not going to get fixed overnight. Well, over time, you know, I think UCLA kind of lost whatever momentum it had. And, you know, I think there's been some positive. I mean, Mario Cristobal getting on to Oregon, he's recruited at a pretty high level. I certainly think that Chris Peterson ending up as the head coach of Washington was a huge blessing for that program, and you know, so there are positives, but I just think when your flagship program, the one that is geared more so than any really other other conference has to have a top dog. And when they're kind of stumbling around, that hurts. Because the rest of the league, I don't think, like, you look at Oregon or Washington, you know, and some of the other programs, certainly Utah, they're not out of alignment of where you expect them to be. It's really, it's unfortunate for the Pac-12, but as USC goes, they go. And when USC is a fringe top 25 team, that's holding you back.
When it comes to replacing Larry Scott, who are some commissioner candidates you're keeping an eye on?
Well, the name that I had heard a lot last night, and I don't know if it's a wish candidate, was Oliver Luck, who had led the XFL, but also had been a West Virginia AD. He had worked for the NCAA. He's got a very varied background. Obviously, his son, Andrew, was a great player at Stanford. He knows the Pac-12. And I just think in terms of a lot of Larry Scott's biggest shortcomings, Oliver Luck addresses those. And also he does know what it's like in terms of having to go find a TV deal and having to work on that side of it, because that's going to be a big part of going forward. Is they're going to have to figure out how do they manage the TV relationship, the TV dynamic that's going to come down the pipe, not too far, you know, down the road. And that's a huge deal right now when money is what it is. And I can't tell you how many times, how many years Larry Scott, one of the first questions he would get asked whenever he would do media availability was, what is going on with the Pac-12 network? I mean, I don't think it was an issue of the quality of the Pac-12 network itself. I just think it was a big issue. You couldn't find it. I mean, I live in Los Angeles, and it was just a, like, they couldn't figure it out. They couldn't get anything solved. And I think if you can't do that, when, again, as I said, like, this is a huge metropolitan area that is a big part of the Pac-12 footprint, and that's not getting addressed, something's wrong. And ultimately, whoever takes over, I think, has got to be able to have a better strategy for that, and the optics of how much money the head of the conference is making, where the office is, and how much money that is for rent. It's just kind of a lot of really tone-deaf decisions that I think whoever takes over has got to be more mindful of the optics of that.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey. We're speaking with Fox Sports college football insider Bruce Feldman. Bruce, how important will expansion of the college football playoff be for the next commissioner?
I think it's a big piece of it. Obviously, there hasn't been a lot of Pac-12 teams in the part of this, but I think that's a bigger issue than it certainly is just for the Pac-12. I think it's a big issue for the leadership in college football at all levels. I think it's a big issue for the Group of Five folks who have no real say in this and no real seat at the table, and it's kind of a farce how it's set up. But I think it's an issue for the Big 12, the Big 10. I even think it's a big issue for, you know, even if you're the SEC where you're winning it almost every year, I think that, you know, if there's more money involved then, and there's more teams that you can get in, I think it's beneficial on a lot of levels.
Bruce, one of the surprises that we had here in Seattle is seeing defensive coordinator Pete Kwiatkowski end up taking the job in Texas with Sark. And look, it's 7 years here. He said that it was just time for him to move on. But can you speak to how big of a loss that is for Washington?
Yeah, I mean, look, I a lot of credit to him, because a few years ago when Jimmy Lake was a really hot defensive commodity and some big schools wanted to hire him away, the way to help keep him in Seattle was for Chris Peterson and Pete, who selflessly basically took a step in the background to let them take care of Jimmy Lake and give him that opportunity. And then obviously Jimmy Lake ended up becoming the head coach not that long after that. And I think that, you know, 7 years is a long time for anyone, and I just think that, you know, we're going to see how it goes. It's not easy being a Big 12 defensive coordinator. I think it's a big hire for Steve Sarkisian, and we'll see how it goes. There's a story I'm working on now, really, about Texas and what they inherit. And he's going to inherit some really good pieces, some really good young talent, and I'm interested to see how it goes there, because, you know, look, at one point Tom Herman looked like he had that thing ready to turn the corner, and then it just completely fell apart on him, and we'll see what Sark can do there.
Yeah, I'm very curious, Bruce, about Sark. I mean, we know how great of a coach he is from an X's and O's standpoint. The question has always been from a culture standpoint, right? And how can he sustain that and keep that going? I think that will be one of the biggest tests for him down in Texas. But, Bruce, I've been through the transfer situation more times than I would have liked to in my college career. Went through it twice, and that was a big deal at the time. I mean, transferring was a big deal at the time and wasn't thought of too fondly. And now we're in an era where it's kind of entering the wild, wild west in terms of the transfer portal and it being more available to college athletes. How is that changing the landscape of recruiting? And is that going to change the landscape of it for, you know, you look at it from an NFL perspective, you have college personnel guys and you have NFL personnel guys that are evaluating NFL talent within their league. Are we going to see a shift in recruiting in that way in the college football landscape as well?
Well, we're seeing a shift in some degree in philosophy when it comes to signing. I mean, if you're sitting out there going, look, these players can get eligible this year, depending on circumstance. I think there are a lot of coaches who say, you know what, instead of signing 25 guys, and most of them are high school or JC guys, I'm going to leave myself open two or three spots to fill some holes on my roster to take, whether they're grad transfers or just straight up transfers who could get eligible immediately. You still need room. It's not the 85-man scholarship limit. It's a 25-person counter. And I think the best example of that was LSU missed out a few years ago on a 5-star cornerback who ended up being a really good player at Alabama, Patrick Surtain. But because they had that spot open, they were able to get Joe Burrow. Joe Burrow obviously was one of Heisman and led them to a national title. Certainly that's going to be the rare exception of the transfer who works out that great. But in terms of just filling roster needs, I think there's a lot of opportunity. Now, the downside of this, and this is the part that, you know, I remember doing a story for The Athletic about, but I just don't think people kind of get this part of it enough, is there's a ton of people who announce on Twitter that they're going in the portal. There aren't a lot of scholarship availability for those same players to land. So for every player that was a former 4-star guy that started and maybe was a good player, you know, there's plenty of other guys who, hey, maybe they had some offers out of high school from those same schools that they're trying to listen to, but those other schools may not have spots anymore. So I think that's the question, is for how many people are out there, how many scholarship spots do they actually have?
Hey, I'm going to stick with, speaking of Burrow, a little bit of an NFL conversation here. Actually, with a question about Urban Meyer, just while we're covering all our bases. What do you feel about the fit for Urban Meyer in Jacksonville?
Well, you know, in terms of, he has the first pick in the draft. I know from having worked with him this past year at Fox that he saw Trevor Lawrence, the Clemson quarterback, in person, beat Ohio State a year ago, and he was really wowed by what he saw up close and on the field. There's a lot of cap space for him now to take free agents in. I think they have 4 picks in the first 45, so there's a chance to flip the roster. I mean, but this is a really awful program that was 1-15 that he's taking over. And so I'm interested to see how Urban will handle not just losing, because it's not something that, you know, like all head coaches hate it. He looked like, whenever it was a bad game, he would look absolutely devastated. And if you're the head coach of an NFL team, especially when it was 1-15, you're going to lose a lot. And also, you know, it's been a while since we've seen Urban Meyer have many games where he has less talent than the other team. I mean, it almost never happened when he was at Ohio State, unless they were playing off, you know, an Alabama or Clemson team. And even then, his teams had, you know, were loaded with talent. Now, it's going to be a different story. And so we'll see how he does. I'm interested to see. I know, like I said, from being around him this fall on every Saturday and Friday, that I think he was more curious about the NFL than he was about, you know, being a college coach, because he's been there, done that. And I'm fascinated to see how he does. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if it went great. It wouldn't surprise me if it was a lot more of a headache, a lot more of a challenge for him than, you know, maybe he's realizes. I don't know. I mean, I think he's done his due diligence. It's just, you know, there's a reason why a lot of great coaches, I mean, there's a Pete Carroll is the exception. Jimmy Johnson were the exceptions of guys who went from the NFL, went from college and had huge success in the NFL. There's a lot of guys who are brilliant coaches who end up struggling to be 500 in the NFL.
He is Fox Sports College Football Insider Bruce Feldman. Bruce, we've learned a ton. We've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Again, this hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. Jake Heap, Stacey Rost here. It is 12:15. That means it's time for Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Mac and Jack's African Amber Ale.
With Jake and Stacey.
We live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
First down, Jake, what is the Seahawks' biggest challenge in their offensive coordinator search?
The biggest challenge is that they're not the only ones. I mean, when you think about how many other offensive coordinator positions that are open around the league as of right now, the Seahawks are in a unique position where they are going to have to be in competition for some of these names. And that's why I believe in this process. We've heard some really weird names floated around, Adam Gase being one of them, Kirby Wilson being one of them, and I do believe that they are probably guys that Pete did interview and go through that process with. But at the same time, if you think about it from a competitive advantage, I don't know if we're going to hear a whole lot more about who they're interviewing. Maybe we will, but I wouldn't be surprised if this went dark just a little bit from that perspective. I don't think that the Seahawks will want to show their cards as you get deeper and deeper into this process, because you don't want anybody else to snag who you're going after or tip your cap of who you're going after. So that's the one thing that I'm going to be intrigued about, because Stacey, if they were really like churning these guys out and interviewing them and looking through everybody, don't you think we would have heard more names by now?
You would think so.
I mean, we've only heard how many? Four, five at this point? I mean, so that's the one thing that as I've really started to think about this from an interviewing process, I do think that we're in an interesting stage now where that Pete Carroll and the Seahawks probably are going to do everything they can to not tip their cap too much as to who they want to hire, who they want to go after, for that very reason, competitive advantages.
Second down. Stacey.
Yeah.
While I've got you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're on the topic of Jamal Adams
sure
today.
Are.
What do some of these top safety contracts look like?
All right. Now, the most important thing is that the best deals are usually reserved for free safeties, which makes sense. You got a lot of ground to cover. You got a lot of responsibilities. You got to be fast and rangy and able to tackle. It
They're
commands
free
a lot.
Safeties. They shouldn't be commanding
exactly
much money at all.
It should
right?
be free,
yeah.
But it's not. No. So we are going to jump into a conversation at 12:45 about what these negotiations should look like. Jake will be heading that up. It's going to be a ton of insight. Before we get to that, I'm going to revisit what the contracts are that the Seahawks are looking at. So Adams' market value on SpotTrack is $12.7 million per year, or a five-year deal worth $63 million. Nope, nuh-uh. He's going to want a lot more than that, I would imagine. I think Jake would concur. So the top paid safety in terms of total value is Landon Collins. He signed a six-year, $84 million deal in March 2019. Now, that averages $14 million per year. Since then, you've had two deals change the market. In January of last year, Eddie Jackson signed a four-year, $58.4 million deal, or about $14.6 per year. Then in August, now this is the most recent and most relevant one, Buda Baker signed a four-year, $59 million deal, about $14.75. Baker's is currently the highest average salary. We can assume then that Jamal Adams would be seeking to at least break that, at least get $15 million per year. Jake, though, has a number that might surprise you. He could be looking for a bit more than that. That's coming up at 12:45. Did you see that tease I threw in there with it, too? Yeah. Bam!
Pro.
Thank Radio you. Pro
Thank
right
you.
Here. Third down. We'll just replay that tease the rest of the show today. Put that one on the highlight reel. Jake, who will be the two most talked about NFL draft prospects in 2021?
There will be a lot of prospects that we will go through.
Mm-hmm.
But the two most that will be talked about from a national perspective is going to be at the quarterback position. And no, it's not going to be Trevor Lawrence. everybody knows that Trevor Lawrence is going to be a Jacksonville Jaguar. Like, we just know that that is what's going to happen. But really where the controversy comes into play is who's quarterback number two. And it's really a toss-up right now if you talk to everybody in the media and you talk to certain people in evaluation scouting departments between Justin Fields, quarterback at Ohio State, and Zach Wilson, quarterback at BYU. Those two guys are going to be heavily scrutinized through this process because those two guys bring unique skill sets. Obviously, BYU's quarterback Zach Wilson did not play against great competition through the entire season this last year, but displayed an incredible amount of talent, a unique skill set, and one that has been really drawing the eye of every evaluator. Now, Justin Fields, he is a prototypical size. He is a guy that really brings a unique skill set in terms of his dual threat ability. Same with Zach Wilson, but he played at Ohio State, right? I mean, he was the Ohio State.
And Ohio State Rivers.
OH.
So.
Go ahead. Sorry, we took you off the rails.
So, with Justin Fields, though, he was a high touted recruit coming out of high school. I was able to work with him at the Elite 11, saw him live in action. I mean, the guy is he's a stud physically, mentally. He's got what you want, and played at the highest level. But those two are really going to draw a lot of comparisons to each other, and that's going to be the big debate: who is quarterback number two in this draft?
Fourth down. First off, Jake, Stacy and I saw him at the Elite 12.
So. Yeah, he also is actually going to come to our quarterback camp. Yeah, I know you and Russ think you're onto something, mm-hmm. but are you part of the Curtis and Stacy Make Quarterbacks Better Than Jake Camp LLC program?
No.
We're going to be making t-shirts. 710, let us know if you want one.
Okay, let me know how that went.
It's going great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fourth down, Jake.
If
Tom Brady and the Bucks get past Green Bay on Sunday, why would this be one of Tom Brady's greatest accomplishments?
Out of all the things, are you okay there?
I'm getting all choked up about all the quarterbacks we're teaching. I'm just so happy for their success.
Me too.
Was that what it was, or was it just exactly a quick spell of dry mouth right
nope.
here?
Yeah,
that,
I mean, nope.
Maybe.
No.
I think it's definitely the
answer first the question, one. Jake. Up against the clock.
This will be one of Tom Brady's greatest accomplishments because he is overcoming the coaching that he is getting right now. And I'm serious. Right now, when you look at this matchup between Green Bay and you look at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I would take Green Bay's coaching staff all day, every day over what Tampa has right now. And if you think about the trajectory of how the season has gone for Tom Brady, it has been rough. It has been bumpy. It has been a process to get on the same page with Bruce Arians and Byron Leftwich. And now they're at a point where they feel like they're somewhat on the same page, but that offense at times feels disconnected. So I think that it's been one of Tom Brady's greatest accomplishments to work with someone like Bruce Arians, who is not an easy guy to work with, by the way, behind the scenes, and to figure that out with and utilize all of the talent that they have there in Tampa on the offensive side of the ball. I think that's pretty remarkable if Tom Brady is going to be able to get back to another Super Bowl at doing that in year one with this group. Pretty incredible.
This morning in the sports pit, Curtis and I played Jake a piece of sound that left him in tears. He was laughing so hard. He hadn't heard it yet. It's worth it, though. Don't spoil it. He had tears in his eyes. He was laughing so hard. We'll play that next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacy.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
From the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line, Jake, 206. Jake, why do you hate on Stacy and Curtis's quarterback camp? Curtis needs this for his daughter. Kids are expensive. Need that supplemental income. Quit hogging all the quarterback camps. This isn't about
you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, 206.
I'm not hogging them.
Yeah, you are. Let us get some of them. We've got to go to... If there was such a thing as Division 5, I'd feel like we'd have the lay of the land there.
You'd have that on lock?
I think so.
Oh, Absolutely. We
easily
would be known.
Easily.
Grand Valley State.
What you guys,
heck yeah.
What you guys need to do is you guys need to, you know, start going to those Pee Wee football games. You guys need to start going to high school games and start scouting.
Who
and
says
start
we're not
recruiting.
Already doing that for our quarterback camp?
Yeah.
Well, you just said you didn't have a lot of clients, so I'm trying to help.
I misspoke.
So many clients.
We have so many that I...
lost track of how many we have.
They all blend into one client, and then I think I have a singular client. Really, though, we also can teach people how to, what we call in the biz, throw the rock.
It's true. Spin it.
We played Jake some sound earlier today that is maybe the funniest clip. It's up there. I also played you the Miss Teen South Carolina.
Yeah,
the
that
answer
one,
about the maps. That
I had,
one.
I had
you
forgotten.
Hadn't heard it? Oh, okay.
I had forgotten about that one. I hadn't heard that one in a long
time. It's so good. I used
time.
To memorize it. I used to know every single word. I hope to get to that point with this clip. This is new Lions head coach Dan Campbell saying he wants his team to be really tough.
Here's what I do know is that this team is going to take on the identity of this city. All right. And the city's been down and it found a way to get up. All right. It's found a way to overcome adversity. All right. And so this team's going to be built on we're going to kick you in the teeth. All right. And when you punch us back, we're going to smile at you. And when you knock us down, we're going to get up. And on the way up, we're going to bite a kneecap off. All right. And we're going to stand up. And then it's going to take two more shots to knock us down. All right. And on the way up, we're going to take your other kneecap and we're going to get up. And then it's going to take three shots to get us down. And when we do, we're going to take another hunk out of you. Before long, we're going to be the last one standing. All right. That's going to be the mentality.
Oh, perfect. It starts out with, we're going to punch you in the teeth. And you're like, right on. Let's go, coach. Let's go. Get physical. And then it turns into, and we're going to bite your kneecap off.
Wait, what?
And then when you knock us down, we're going to smile, blood in our teeth, and we're going to bite your other kneecap.
Oh.
Now you got no kneecaps. How do you feel about that? Omar Ruiz with the tweet of the day. Dan thinks he's coaching literal Lions.
This I thought for
I love
real.
This clip
like
so
I was
much.
Not I was not kidding. I thought for real when I walked in and you played that cut
that
for
it was
me,
fake?
That it was fake.
Absolutely.
No
not.
Way that was a head coach's opening presser.
Can we do it one more time?
Like he said this
just
literally.
One more time. One more
he
time.
Said this in his opening presser, your first impression to that organization, to the players in that locker room.
Yes.
And this is what you say?
Here's what I do know is that this team is going to take on the identity of this city. All right. And the city's been down and it found a way to get up. All right. It's found a way to overcome adversity. All right. And so this team's going to be built on we're going to kick you in the teeth. All right. And when you punch us back, we're going to smile at you. And when you knock us down, we're going to get up. And on the way up, we're going to bite a kneecap off. All right. And we're going to stand up. And then it's going to take two more shots to knock us down. All right. And on the way up, we're going to take your other kneecap and we're going to get up. And then it's going to take three shots to get us down. And when we do, we're going to take another hunk out of you. Before long, we're going to be the last one standing. All right. That's going to be the mentality.
I'd run through a wall for this dude.
You would?
Let's go, coach.
I would.
Those are the speeches I give at my quarterback camp,
I would
Jake.
Bite a kneecap for this man.
I would take a hunk of flesh out of
first
someone
off,
for this man.
First off, I don't think that's physically possible. Your face mask, one, gets in the way of that. Like, you can't get around that. How are you going to bite someone's kneecap?
You take your helmet off. I don't play with a helmet on because I don't play scare, Jake.
Bring my opponent on a spike! That's what he's saying.
I like also that it doesn't start out with, like, hey, you know what? We're going to turn this organization around. We're going to become a winner. We're going to take over this division. It becomes, you know what? We're going to lose, but we're going to bite you on the way down.
He says that
it's
one.
It's amazing.
Okay, but he says it the first time, and you're like, okay, that's a little weird, but like, all
it's
right.
The
I
best
mean,
press conference I've ever
I
heard.
I could get down with that, and then he goes on further.
Yes.
And says...
Yes.
I'm just reading the transcript of this. We're going to take two more shots. It's going to take two more shots to knock us down, and then we'll fall down and we'll get back up, and then it's going to take three more shots to knock us down. It's like this story just went on a turn that just it did not need to go there, and finishing that we're going to take another hunk out of you. So not we've gotten past the two kneecaps. So now we're going to take a hunk out of the midsection, and then we will be the last one standing when it's all said and done. Wow.
Another thing he adds.
I'm crying again. I got
know,
myself to cry
I know.
Again.
Another thing he adds that is not in this clip is when he talks about, he goes, it's going to mean that when you come into Detroit, you're going to have to leave beat up. And I'm talking about it as a team. I'm saying we get the tourists come in. People want to come in. I like the idea that, like, not tourists, though. They're going to have a great time. You guys, though. The Packers, we're going to bite you in half.
We don't want to ruin the tourism here in Detroit. Come on in, but any team that comes in. I you know, with this, Campbell and the way that he's talking, do you see his nameplate as well?
It says the dude. Is that real?
It's head coach.
That's real.
Slash
it's real.
The dude.
Confirmed real, for sure.
That's his title on his nameplate to his office.
Does he have white Russians in his office every morning? It has to be in the morning or else.
I don't know. But this sounds like I hate describing somebody like this, but it sounds like a meathead talking instead of a football coach. I mean, I'm hoping that for him personally, like seriously, I genuinely am hoping for him to be successful as a head coach, to be a true motivator. But to listen to that as the opening presser, man, I am really concerned, because if I'm a player in that locker room, I'm thinking to myself, what the heck is this? What is going on? And if he's going to deliver more speeches like that in a team meeting, especially when things get hard through adversity, that's going to be a message that I tune out real, real fast. I mean, he's got to have a lot more up his sleeve, but my goodness, that is a great soundbite.
It's amazing. I'm squeezing one more story in here. Ravens head coach John Harbaugh defends his team not changing their offense. Cut number 8 right here.
It goes back to the same criticism that we've heard for the last 3 years about not being the type of an offense or the type of a quarterback that some people want to see. And that's just, they're just going to have to live with it, because Lamar Jackson's won a lot of football games here. And our offense has won us a lot of football games here. And we're not apologizing that for 1 second. We are going to improve it, no question about it. We're going to go to work to be more precise, more efficient, better at what we do. That's what we have to do, be better at it. And we'll leave the criticism to the critics. And when they're ready to, you know, coordinate their offense and put their product on the field, I'll be looking forward to competing against it.
That was from a day ago with Harbaugh defending the Ravens' run-heavy offense. I don't mind this approach necessarily when you've got the league's most mobile quarterback, too. I mean, Lamar's got a great arm, but he's also able to just tear it up on the ground game. We saw that last year. They took over the league. Unfortunately for them, both years they went out in the divisional round. So this, it makes sense that there be critiques about it. And obviously it's relevant to us. We've just got about 30 seconds here left, Jake. It's obviously relevant to us because of the critique Seattle faces.
Sure, but for John Harbaugh, I don't have a single problem with what he just said, and I think people are crushing him because he's defending their scheme and their system. But he said we need to make improvements to our system. We need to perfect our system. But yeah, they've won a lot of football games, and when they get that thing going, and you're playing to the strengths of your quarterback, that's what John Harbaugh's doing. That's what Greg Roman is doing. They're not putting their quarterback in a bad position. They are playing to his strengths, and what they need to do is they need to perfect ways to get him more comfortable, to be more comfortable being a pocket passer and being able to beat defenses consistently from the pocket. That's an evolution. That's a growing aspect of Lamar Jackson's game. Everybody knew that, but to sit here after year one of saying last year that this offense was one of the greatest offenses and one of the more innovative offenses in the NFL, to now the very next year saying that this offense is old and unsophisticated, that one I can't get on board with. It just comes down to execution and having a better game plan in the passing game.
Jake's got some advice for Jamal Adams. Is it to bite someone's kneecap off during negotiations? Is that what it is?
No. It won't be.
Okay.
But after the second and third time he gets hit and knocked down,
then it changes.
Then you go after the kneecap.
Okay, so it's not to bite someone's kneecap off, but he'll tell you what it is next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
ESPN's Mina Kimes will be joining us in about 15 minutes. Don't go anywhere. Someone asking on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line if she'd be willing to be the Seahawks offensive coordinator. I'm going to guess no, or that she's just really, really busy. Got a lot of other things to take care of.
I bet you she would offer Lenny, her dog.
Lenny would do a great job, I think. We'll ask her. Ask her if Lenny's interested.
Okay.
It is an outside talent, which we said we wanted. Someone who brings an outside perspective, innovative. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Going to be able to sneak around on the sideline, not bother anyone.
Potential's there.
I think so.
I don't think Pete Carroll could catch up to him. to try and meddle with the play calls. So, I mean, that could be another thing.
Lenny, in case you didn't know, is Mina's dog. So, just in case anyone was stuck. Jake, we were talking about Jamal Adams about an hour ago now. The idea that this is going to be John Schneider's biggest decision of the offseason. Yes, there are many free agents he's got to look at. There's the draft. There's maneuvering free agency with so little cap space. But perhaps the biggest will be figuring out how to handle this extension with someone you gave up two first-round picks and more for with Jamal Adams. Now, I said in Four Down Territory that Jamal Adams' market value as a strong safety is going to be around $12 to $13 million. He will be wanting more than that. How much more is he going to want, Jake? And what is your advice when it comes to this negotiation?
Yeah, this is going to be a complicated one because Jamal Adams doesn't view himself as a particular position. I mean, it's very reminiscent of Jimmy Graham trying to identify himself not as a tight end but as a receiver just based off of how he's utilized and how he played when he was with the New Orleans Saints. I mean, the one thing that I think is really important is, did Jamal Adams enjoy his time here in Seattle? Was there a good, strong, healthy relationship? And here in cut number five, Jamal Adams talks about how he does want to be here, how he really likes it here.
You know, that's something that is out of my hands right now. I sure pray that I am here. I love being a Seattle Seahawk. I love being a part of this organization. It's a special one. Special guys around and young ladies as well. So, you know, when that time comes, it comes. But, you know, I'm worried about getting healthy right now. You know what I mean? And getting back and getting to the flow of everything and figuring out everything. So I'm not really focused on that right now.
So that was during the season, and I think everything went extremely well. From Jamal Adams, the way he worked here, the personality fit, and what the organization thinks of him as the player, right? They wouldn't have traded two first-round picks and a couple third-round picks and all that for a player that they didn't think highly of. So, as I said before, this will be the most important, the most challenging contract negotiation that John Schneider and the Seahawks have had to date, by far. Mm-hmm. But in this process for Jamal Adams, there's three key things, in my opinion, as you look through the history of the negotiating process with this organization. Number one is patience.
Okay.
You have to have patience in this process, and you have to understand the timeline of when the Seahawks conduct their business. They have been different with some guys, but for the most part in their history, even with their extensions and re-signings, typically those have come in the spring, in the summer, and yes, even right up till training camp. So that's typically when they go through, because they want to focus on certain steps along the process of free agency, and they don't want to get sidetracked. They don't want to have too many things on their plate, so they try and space it out. And you look at Wagner, Bobby Wagner most recently. His deal didn't get done until the summer. Russell Wilson, he put a deadline on so that the Seahawks would be forced to get their negotiations done at a certain point in time in the springtime. It was around April, May when that deadline was set so that they could get it done and in that time frame, or else it would have continued to linger on further. So with Jamal Adams, you have to have patience in this process, which leads me to my second one, Stacey, is thick skin. Don't take things personally. The Seahawks are very fierce negotiators. They're fair. They give guys big deals, and they've been willing to do that for their star players over the years, Stacey. But what they are is they are very frugal. They are not going to overpay. They are not going to reset the market. They are not interested in doing that as an organization. Look at every single contract, every big-time contract that they have made over their tenure. It has not been overly dramatic in terms of completely resetting the market. It's giving them the top deal at the time, but within reason. And with Jamal Adams wanting probably somewhere between 18 to 20, you're asking to make this organization reset the safety market, and they don't want to do that.
Can I know you have your third point to get to. Since we have a couple minutes, I have a follow-up question here. Can you explain why Adams would want 18 to 20? Because that would reset the market by about $3 million per year in salary from the top safety in annual salary, which is Buda Baker.
Yeah, very simply put, because Jamal Adams is used also as a pass rusher. You were using Jamal Adams' skill set as a pass rusher, his unique skill set to blitz the quarterback and get home in a way that most safeties in this league are not. And so when you think about it from that aspect, there are certain questions about Jamal Adams' coverage. I thought that, for me personally, those questions were answered for me when you saw Jamal Adams healthy. And at the end of the season, I thought he did a really good job in coverage towards the end of the season. I think that that will get taken care of and will be settled down for Seahawks fans.
Okay.
But he had 9.5 sacks. He was your leading sack getter, Stacey. Leading sack getter. So this is not your average safety when it comes to how he plays the game or how you utilize him. And that's why his price could be higher than just the normal safety market.
So number one is patience. Number two is thick skin. What's number three?
Number three is crystal clear communication. And I believe that this is the biggest one. In the past, we have heard, and I think that a lot of controversy over Russell Wilson's negotiation process as to, well, why is Russell Wilson demanding a deadline now? And it feels like it's only 3 weeks and you're putting the organization in a really bad spot. That wasn't the case. Russell Wilson, Mark Rogers gave the Seattle Seahawks fair warning months in advance of when they would like to have this deal done. And there was not a whole lot of communication through the process. Bobby Wagner, and so, you know, that's why you saw it become the circus it did with a month left to go on that deadline. Bobby Wagner's was quiet because I believe that Bobby was one more patient, and also the fact that he was able to handle things in-house with him as his own representation. He was not concerned about the timeline in which it got done. But for Jamal Adams, who just walked away from a situation in New York where I believe it not only was how bad they were in terms of the on-field product, but it was how the organization, how he felt the organization wronged him by the miscommunication that was there,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether that's him misinterpreting what they're saying, either way, it was not clear for Jamal Adams.
We've seen that in other markets. I mean, look at what's going on in Houston right now. A big part of that, according to multiple reports, is that the organization promised Deshaun Watson something. They told him something, and then they backed off on it.
Correct.
So it's not a player expecting too much or being demanding. It is a player entering into an agreement with the organization or an understanding with the organization and the organization having an about face.
Exactly. And if I'm Jamal Adams, this helps me deal with the first two pieces of advice, the patience aspect of it and the thick skin aspect of it in terms of not being offended by what the Seahawks offer you on that initial table. When they offer you, because I guarantee you they're probably going to offer him that $15 million, 15.5, maybe 15.75, which is somewhere just a little bit over what Buda Baker made, Jamal Adams probably isn't going to like that offer. And the Seahawks, if you go back, the Legion of Boom era, it was all great before when? Before when
people got to get paid.
Before people got to get paid. And when people think that they are worth a certain amount, and the Seahawks came back and said, no, this is what we believe you're worth. And that offended a lot of players in that process, and it fractured some relationships there along the way. And for Jamal Adams, if I'm him, I am asking for crystal clear communication. When are we going to negotiate this contract? When do we want to get this deal done? And let's be crystal clear about where my value is throughout the entire process. If the between the organization and the player can handle those three things, and if Jamal Adams can take those three pieces of advice, I think that this isn't a drama-filled process. I think that the Seahawks and the player can get a deal done that everybody can walk away happy with and ready to move forward.
What other decisions do the Seahawks have to make this offseason? What can we learn from the divisional round of games? What can we learn from this upcoming championship round of games? How's this OC search going? All of those important questions. Well, we've got someone to answer them. It's ESPN's Mina Kimes. She joins us next.